This is a BloomerBoomer.com podcast with our movie reviewer and historian, Greg Potasik, who spent a lifetime reporting on the movie industry. Whether writing for The Hollywood Reporter or co-founding the celebrated music magazine Rock, BloomerBoomer.com Greg takes the films popular when baby boomers came of age and masterfully intertwines them with today's newest releases. Greg's co-host is Andy Asher.
Well, hi, everyone. If you're listening for the first time to Greg's Boomer Films Review, this is the first one for us, too, and we will schedule them at least monthly. Now, Greg does something really unique. What he does is he selects a film of the baby boomer era, and then along with a current film, and he reviews the two and draws parallels to what distinguishes the two of them. And he also brings us back to the times in which they were originally done. Now, Greg talks about his background in our first podcast today, and you'll find out that he has a fascinating background in the world of films. So, without any further ado, let's start today's show. Greg, I know you travel around a lot, so whether it's at the Sundance Film Festival or at home, where are you coming from today?
I'm calling you, I'm talking to you from Hollywood, where I can report it's a beautiful sunset.
And I know those Hollywood sunsets can be a sight to behold. Well, Greg, this is perfect, the perfect environment, and this is being our first podcast for in a series, but why don't you go ahead and just share with us a little bit about yourself, because you're certainly not new to all this.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've had a career as a reporter and journalist, writer in the entertainment industry since the 1980s. In fact, my first job in the industry was with MGM. I was a music supervisor, of all things, for one of their production companies. And from there, I utilized my background in journalism. I have a master's degree in journalism from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications to begin a career as a freelance journalist here in Los Angeles. Eventually, I joined the Hollywood Reporter, the daily trade newspaper. And eventually, I went to the other side and became a publicist for the studios, including New Line Cinema, Gramercy, which was a joint distribution arm between Europe's Polygram and Universal Studio. And ultimately, I ended my career at the studios at the Walt Disney Studio, where I was a director of publicity. Then I also became a publicist for Rogers & Cowan, which is a major entertainment PR firm here in Hollywood. And then I was also the communications director for the American film market, which is one of the three large film markets, not film festivals, but film markets in the world. And I continue to write and do independent publicity.
That's such a great story. And the part where you said you went to the other side from the Hollywood Reporter, I guess that took some adjustment, didn't it?
Well, here was my thinking. Reporting is a wonderful job. And when you worked in the early 90s, like I did, for one of the two trade newspapers, one of the daily trade newspapers. Now imagine this, there's no other industry like this that had two daily newspapers competing against each other for one industry. So it was very much, you know, like the rivalry of the century when it came to beating your competition on stories. So it was exciting. It was an adrenaline rush for the first couple of years, but ultimately, you know, it became a little bit just like information gathering. And often it was information brokering. So you would have to do favors for producers, for example, write articles about their next slate of films if they gave you inside information as to what the next studio release was going to be. But after a while, I got sort of tired of that. I wanted to do something more creative. And so I wanted to be part of those organizations that were creating the films rather than just reporting on the films.
Bring me up to date. Are both those publications still around? The Hollywood Reporter is, isn't it?
Well, they're both still around. They don't publish daily print editions anymore. So they've eventually and ultimately gone online. After lots of bumps and starts, they've been sold and resold. They're not the power brokers they used to be. So rather than embracing the internet and owning it, they let it slip through their fingers and other websites. For example, like TMZ and websites that were associated with TV shows, again, like TMZ, became more prominent or as prominent. So in the day, in the 90s, and before that, they were the definitive voices of Hollywood. And being a reporter for one of those two publications, people would take your phone calls because, you know, you could really shine a spotlight on a project. Or, you know, if you were doing an investigative piece, you could, you know, shine a spotlight on some shenanigans going on. So I remember one article, for example, that I did at the Reporter was actually about blacklisted actors in the late 50s because of the McCarthy hearings, right? And it was an investigation to how and who actually participated in the studios in that blacklisting. And given that I had benefit of you know, 20 or 30 years cushion so that people were more comfortable in talking about the past, I was able to reveal some interesting information about that era.
You're an encyclopedia of Hollywood, and that's almost a topic for a number of other podcasts, and so maybe we'll mark that once. But before we get either farther off course than we already have, why don't we jump into these two movies? Because, well, you tell the story of how the similarities and so on.
Well, we're talking today about Marooned, which is a 1967 film, Hollywood film, that advanced the genre known as space travel. So on the Baby Boomer film, we're talking about that film. On the contemporary film that links to it, of course, I'm talking about this year's Gravity. It's the Alfonso Cuarón film, the director, the Spanish director, and it's the film that stars, of course, Sandra Bullock. The films are naturally linked because they're about space travel, and I wanted to make the distinction between space travel and science fiction. So space travel films are either about the present-day space technology or the near future, so that it's the technology that likely could happen in the next 10 or 15 years, rather than science fiction films, which often advance time travel, you know, centuries into the future. Science fiction films often are less technology-oriented and more about creative story and characters, often alien beings and so on. Obviously, in space travel, you would never have alien beings because that's not realistic. So there's a certain realism to space travel films. And the reason why I thought Marooned was a good film to revisit, because it really did advance that genre. Prior to that, most space travel films really bordered on being science fiction films, like very creative imaginations of what space travel might be, could be. But this film had that almost documentary realism you into space. And of course, this is when space travel was the focus of the entire sort of science community at that time. You know, with President Kennedy's mandate to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade in the 60s, the space travel really captured people's imagination in a way that it doesn't anymore. Space travel, I think, today is sort of rote. I mean, I think the time when the first astronaut goes to Mars, it will have the same kind of excitement that space travel did in the 60s, but we're long past that. So Marooned was the first film that realistically brought the moviegoer into space. And the cinematography, it was extraordinary. You really did feel like you were up in that space capsule with Richard Crenna, Gene Hackman, and James Franciscus, the three astronauts who become, as the title implies, marooned in space.
What a great cast of names, and you know that I saw the trailers of that, so I have not seen the entire film, but as you say, it really documents space travel then, and you know, it makes you wonder today in this day and age, is there going to be room for sci-fi because so much has already been actually happened.
Well, it's a good point, it's funny you bring that up, because the other film that capped off that decade was, of course, 2001's A Space Odyssey, and it also advanced the space travel genre by really melding in a very realistic way space travel and science fiction for the first time. So it was also about the near future, but not quite as near as Marooned. Rather than, you know, 2 or 3 years in the future, 5 years, it thought of space in maybe 20 or 30 years. But still, it was realistic enough that we could imagine ourselves being, you know, on that spaceship. I remember, Andy, I don't know if you remember this too, in 2000 Space Odyssey, and we're digressing here for a moment, but let's go ahead and do that. Sure. You know, the spaceship had the Pan Am logo on it.
Oh, isn't that great? Yes, yeah, I do now remember that.
Right? And of course, Pan Am doesn't even exist anymore, but it really marks it as a 60s film. But back to Maroon, Maroon had that special quality of having really advanced space technology as depicted in fiction film to a whole new level.
Yes, well, it all would look practically as if they're right over there at Cape Canaveral or Vandenberg or wherever the space shot was taken. It was so realistic. They had everything down right to the nut and the screw in the nut and so forth.
Well, and it's partly because of the source material for the screenplay. The film was based on a novel by Martin Caden. He was a prolific novelist who specialized in stories often involving aeronautics technology or space. His book, Marooned, which the film, of course, is named after, originally revolved around the story of a Mercury spacecraft astronaut, one astronaut, and it had the same more or less storyline that he was marooned in space. 4 years later, in 1969, and this was just 4 months after the real-life Apollo 11 spacecraft successfully touched it down on the moon, the film based on the novel was released. So it was almost time, or rather art was imitating life, and life was imitating art.
Some of the write-ups I've seen on Gravity, it's gotten so much credit for the pacing and of how it was put together. And in a lot of ways, Maroon also had a pretty unique pacing, I thought really stood out. But in Gravity, I guess the very first shot, or practically the first shot, where you're looking down at Earth, that is unforgettable.
Totally unforgettable. And as impressive as Maroon's cinematography was at the time, it of course pales in comparison to that of Gravity's because of the advance of high definition technology and specifically cinematography. So the pictures are so crisp and so realistic. There's almost no need for anyone to ever go into space and take watch Gravity as an experience. But like Maroon, the action really happens less about what's happening to the characters and more about what's not happening. In other words, if the suspense is built because they are having to wait for something that they weren't supposed to have to wait for. Everything, technology promised that everything was going to go off without a hitch, right? This is the great promise of advanced technology. And in both of these films, of course, there's a hiccup. And just a small little deviation from the norm collapses this technological promise that they're safe. And that begins, of course, the suspense in the story, in both stories.
Yeah, well, that they did that well. And then, of course, I have not seen all that many current 3D films, and I did see Gravity in 3D. And
was it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's literally where you flinch when something comes your way because you think you have to get out of the way, you know?
And in that film, there's a lot of space debris coming your way, right?
Oh, yes, all the time. Yeah, no, that, and I'd seen 3D, you know, back in another generation or practically, but this takes it to a whole new level.
Well, hey, listen, and I'll close with this thought. You know, even though the technology of the two films and even the storyline of adventure in space and a story of self-sacrifice, and I won't go beyond that, because that would be a spoiler, but there is a story of self-sacrifice in each of the films. And in fact, the director of Gravity was influenced by the story of Marooned. He saw it when he was a little boy. I think that the biggest advance that gravity brings in terms of advancing the space travel genre is not so much its high-definition technology, although that's very impressive, but the technology of the two spacecrafts really aren't that much different. What is different, though, are the characters. So in the original film that we're talking about, the Marooned, all the main characters, and notably the astronauts, were men, right? But in Gravity, the main character is a woman, and she's not somebody's wife, like Lee Grant was the wife of one of the space astronauts in Marooned. She is she's a scientist, and she's an astronaut. And the picture is largely Sandra Bullock. So I'd say she occupies about 75% of the screen time, an extraordinary opportunity and role for an actress. And by the way, she's shortlisted on everyone's list for Best Actress Oscar this year, which would be another extraordinary feat if she had two back-to-back Best Actress Oscars, because she won the Oscar last year. But it's a big surprise that she came out, out of the left field with this film and got instant critical acclaim. But the closest thing that I think we've seen in cinema where a female actor is the lead character in a film about space travel, and she's more than someone's assistant or anything else, that she's the scientist, was, of course, Alien. But that, again, now borders more on science fiction, because then, of course, we have, as the name implies, aliens. So in terms of space travel films, Bullock has achieved something just by the fact that she is the first actress, female actor, to have a lead role in a space travel film.
He is in this film. Well, that's a fascinating point. Any glimpse about what you're going to be talking about next time?
Well, I think, I tend to gravitate towards films that that push the envelope, if you will, in terms of creative cinema. And I think the film that I'm going to focus in on next time is 12 Days a Slave. No doubt you've heard about this film.
Oh, yes. It's a powerful one. I've been hearing a lot about it.
Yes, it's very controversial. It's critically acclaimed. Again, it's on a short list of films that will be nominated for Oscars. And again, it's a game, much like Marooned and Gravity were game changers. This film is in its own way, as in the way it deals with the depiction of race relations in America. It's a game changer, but we'll talk about that more next time.
Sounds good, Greg. Hey, as always, thanks again, and we'll talk to you then.
All right, I'll talk to you from Hollywood soon.
Thanks for listening to this BloomerBoomer.com podcast with movie reviewer and historian Greg Potasik. You can also catch Greg's film reviews for the international lifestyle and entertainment website, Monsters and Critics. We encourage you to leave a comment in the reply section of the podcast. Finally, we would love it if you'd register to receive our BloomerBoomer.com newsletter with more of Greg's movie reviews. Thanks again.